From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome once again to Washington Watch. We continue with our tour in Israel. We got a special program for you this evening, looking at national security from an Israeli perspective. Caroline Glick joins us. She is the deputy managing editor of the Jerusalem Post. And as we have been traveling the country, looking at the not only the history, the biblical sites, but taking in the current present day geopolitical environment here in Israel, in the Middle East, we've heard from some fascinating just insightful speakers, and Caroline Glick is one of those. And Caroline, welcome to Washington Watch.
Oh, it's so great to be on your program, and so great to be talking to all of you here in Israel. Thanks for coming.
Well, we have before us our audience of about 200 of our friends and supporters from across the country, 23 states represented on this tour. And so you guys are a great audience. Welcome to Washington Watch. And folks, you can check out the website, TonyPerkins.com, if you happen to miss anything on your way home. This is one interview you're going to want to see or listen to in its entirety. It'll be archived at TonyPerkins.com a little bit later. And if you want to keep up with us, you can do so on Twitter, at T. Perkins. All right, Caroline, interesting time to be here in the Middle East. I mean, in just a few weeks, we're going to see something that is quite significant. For nearly a quarter of a century, the United States has said that its embassy is to be in Jerusalem, but always found these excuses not to do it. We now have a president who says we're doing it, and it's going to happen next month.
And God bless President Donald Trump. What an amazing leader. I mean, really, you can't imagine the admiration that Israelis feel for him because, as he said, he talks the talk and he walks the walk. He promised and he's delivering. And it's an amazing thing, and it's going to have extraordinary implications for the good, I believe, in the Middle East, for prospects for peace and for American national security and Israeli national security. So once again, God bless President Trump.
Caroline, were Israelis surprised that Donald Trump made that decision?
You know, I think that yes, because we've been jaded. You know, every 4 years there's another American presidential election. And every 4 years, whoever's, you know, the candidates always say, I'm going to move the embassy to Jerusalem. I pledge to move the embassy to Jerusalem. Well, except for Barack Obama, was nice enough to say that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel when he was running in 2008 and then didn't say it in 2012. But, you know, since 1992, maybe even before that, since I think Reagan promised to move the embassy to Jerusalem, and it never happened. So over time, we stopped caring, and it became more of a line to try to attract votes of Americans, but not actually trying to convince the Israelis of the seriousness of the pledge. So here came Donald Trump, and he said it. And people just raised their eyebrows and said, well, okay, great. You know, but and then he did, you know, and he was serious. So that's a big difference.
Well, and I think Israel is not alone in that response to a president who actually keeps his promises. In terms of conservative evangelical Christians, what we would describe, or George Barna describes as sage cons, after 1 year in office, a poll of those sage cons, the spiritually active, governmentally engaged Christians, 51% say that President Trump exceeded their expectations in the policies that he enacted as president. You know, we're here at of course, the Middle East is always volatile. And, you know, it's an understatement to say this is a tough neighborhood to live in the Middle East. Syria, a cauldron of confusion and just different parties involved there with Iran, Russia,
Turkey.
I mean, you've got a whole mix of things. But in the middle of this, is Israel forging greater alliances with other Middle Eastern countries?
We are. You know, the natural ally for Israel inside of Syria are the Kurds, And they really could use some significant support, but that's a different issue. But we have, because what happened was the Sunni Arab world has been undergoing, I wouldn't say exactly a revolution, sort of an implosion, and a lot of the countries that all of the wise men said would never change, Egypt, Yemen, Algeria, Tunisia, all of these countries started, you know, basically falling apart. The regimes that were always there and never changed were crumbling, and they were being replaced by Muslim fundamentalists from the Muslim Brotherhood and affiliated organizations. And so suddenly the Sunnis realized that the Muslim Brotherhood and Iran are in alliance, and that their strongest ally in fighting both of these forces is Israel. And actually, the thing that they need most is not to destroy Israel, it's to work with Israel. And so you have a commonality of interests that have pushed events in the Middle East in a profound manner, really, since 2011, 2012, and with each passing year, as Iran becomes more and more empowered, particularly as a result of what the United States was doing during the Obama presidency, you see that the concern of the Sunni Arab regimes, led by the Saudis and by the Sisi government in Egypt, their desire to develop working alliance with Israel to defeat Iran and to defeat ISIS and Muslim Brotherhood offshoots and the Muslim Brotherhood grows. So this is an extraordinary development, and it's changed the face of the Middle East from a balance of power perspective in a profound way.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So glad to have you with us. Caroline Glick, my guest. She is the managing editor of the Jerusalem Post. She grew up in Chicago, outside of Chicago, and made Aliyah, coming to Israel in 1991. And you served in the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces. I give that background for my next question. Iran, obviously working with Hamas when it comes to what's happening in Gaza. What can you tell us about Hamas continually being supplied with weapons and other materials that are being used against Israel?
I mean, it's interesting because in 2005, Israel withdrew its military forces from Gaza and expelled forcibly some 8,500 Israeli citizens who lived in 24 different settlements in the Gaza Strip. And so from 1967, at the end of the Six-Day War, through August of 2005, when Israel withdrew, Israel was in control of the international border between Gaza and Sinai, Egypt. And then beginning in the middle of August of 2005, the control over that international border was ceded to the Palestinians. And in the 6 months that passed from August of 2005 through February of 2006, according to then head of the Shin Bet Israeli Security Agency, Avi Dichter, or was it Yuval Diskin? I don't remember. Anyway, the head of the Shin Bet said that more weapons had flowed across the Egyptian border into Gaza than had passed through that border in all of the years that Israel had controlled it, from 1967 through 2005, cumulatively, you know, in absolute quantities. More weapons had passed through that border in the weeks and months that followed Israel's withdrawal than had passed through in the previous, 38 years. So this is just an extraordinary change. I mean, for the entire time that Israel was in control of Gaza, it was no more than a tactical nuisance for Israel. You know, the incendiary bombs that they were able to use against Israel couldn't reach more than, I think, 20-kilometer range. That Ari would correct me if I'm wrong, within, you know, 5 or 10 kilometers one way or another. And today, they can reach almost everywhere in Israel. I mean, they can reach the Jerusalem region. They can reach Gush Etzion. They can reach Hadera, they were getting close to Haifa. I mean, this is changing what had been a tactical nuisance into something that's, you know, approaching a more strategic concern. And so that's what we're seeing. And they got supplies through Egypt all of these years. That was coming in through Libya. A lot of the mass amounts of weaponry that was coming through expanded after the fall of Gaddafi, because then ISIS and other related Sunni jihadist organizations took over in Libya, and then they sort of passed through Egypt, across the Sinai, into Gaza. And so that was from Libya, and then we also are having, obviously, a problem of Iran transferring weapons as well, and the seating of Hezbollah trainers inside of Gaza. They used to have to leave the Gaza Strip in order to go to Lebanon or to Iran for training, and then they moved the Hezbollah trainers into the Gaza Strip so that, you know, they were able to localize a lot of the development of the weaponry. It's a problem. And then you have the opposite system, which is the West and the UN and the EU, that's constantly pushing Israel to allow the importation of more and more dual-use items into the Gaza Strip under the guise of humanitarian assistance. So you have to bring in concrete. Oh, they need to rebuild Gaza. You have to let them bring in concrete so they can build buildings and all the rest of it. But they don't build the buildings. They build the weapons tunnels, like the one that went out into that wheat field in 2014. And this is what they're using, tons and tons and tons of concrete that they're demanding that Israel allow to be imported into Gaza to build. And so this is what happens when you allow a terrorist organization to build a fiefdom in Gaza. And one last point about that is that Gaza is not only like Afghanistan-like, a mini-Afghanistan on the edge of Israel and Egypt, threatening both countries. And we see the insurgency in the Sinai is very much related to Gaza being under the control of Hamas. But it's also, over the years, become more and more of a hub for just sort of global jihadists that are free-flowing through Gaza, so that it becomes a hub for global jihad in a way that, of course, it never was when Israel was in control of the area. And so, you know, this is the kind of system that we're dealing with. It's both cooperating with, you know, with the Sunni jihadists of the Daesh, of the ISIS and Al-Qaeda types. It's operating on its own. It's operating in coordination and cooperation with Hezbollah through Iran. And it has become, in and of itself, a hub for global terrorism that threatens the countries of the region, that threatens Egypt in particular and Israel. But also from Gaza, you see terrorism then emanating out, and it's capable of threatening all over. And one last point here, that, you know, they had a Hamas terrorist who was killed by assassins on a motorcycle on his way into a mosque on Saturday morning in Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia. And Hezbollah, interestingly, joined Hamas in alleging that Israel and the Mossad were behind the assassination.
We're going to have to pick that up on the other side of this break. I want you to finish that. And I also want to talk to you about the two-state solution that we hear about so often. Is that the solution? All right, folks, you're listening to Washington Watch. This is coming to you from Israel as we continue our tour throughout the Holy Land. Don't go away. I'm coming back with more of Caroline Glick after this. Hello, this is Tony Perkins from Washington Watch. You know, in all my years here at the Family Research Council, one of the things that encourages me the most about you, our listeners, is your willingness to help advance the things that matter most: faith, family, and freedom. Your support is enabling FRC to play a major role in the current administration's actions to protect religious freedom, as well as rolling back threats to pastors' free speech rights, just to name a few. But your help is needed for the work ahead as we seek to protect religious freedom in the military and finally defund Planned Parenthood. Please stand with FRC right at this moment. You can make your gift by going to TonyPerkins.com or make a gift by calling 1-800-225-4008. Again, our number 800-225-4008, or go to TonyPerkins.com. God bless you, and may God bless the United States of America.
Hey, I'm back. I brought food. What's the score?
98%.
What?
My congressman got a 98% on the Family Research Council Action scorecard.
You are such a nerd.
Family Research Council Action created a new scorecard to help others understand how well their member of Congress is doing on the things that are important to you. Like how your representatives voted on taxpayer funding for abortion, repealing and replacing Obamacare, the confirmation of Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court, and other important legislation relating to faith, family, and freedom.
Really? I barely know my congressman. Let me look this up. How do I get the info on this?
Go to frcaction.org/scorecard. Once you find out how your representative voted on these issues, you should let them know your thoughts and keep them accountable. Whoa, you're typing it all wrong. It's frcaction.org/scorecard.
Okay, I got it now. I'll keep an eye for my representatives for any foul balls.
Somewhere out there right now, a teacher is using a new technique. Not to teach some new math method, but to control the emotions of children in the classroom. Sounds like a conspiracy theory, doesn't it? It's not. Social-emotional learning, known as SEL, is a new catchphrase that now dominates public education policy. However, hidden behind the SEL claim of building kids' self-confidence is a statist agenda of social engineering that insists on total conformity of thought. It disregards the genuine individuality of students and their family relationships and requires monitoring and tracking of their emotions. Don't miss FRC's new speaker series event featuring Stella Morabito, in which she discusses how SEL is programming our children by enforcing conformity, invading privacy, and undermining the influence of family and faith in a child's life. Learn more at frc.org/SEL. Again, that's frc.org/SEL.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. So glad to have you with us. As I mentioned, we're recording this live before an audience of all of our friends that came with us to Israel. So glad to have you here tonight with us. Caroline Glick, our special guest tonight, Deputy Managing Editor of the Jerusalem Post. And we're talking about a number of things. And I do want to get to the issue of the two-state solution, because we hear about that so much. The previous administration, in fact, every administration says that that's the solution. But I want you to finish what we were talking about as we were discussing Gaza and just the complexities there. And I do want to ask you about, with President El-Sisi in Egypt, if that has helped in stemming some of the flow of this material into Gaza Strip.
So, yes, and just to close that last thought, so they're operating in Malaysia, in Kuala Lumpur. They have a very large hub of operations in South Africa. So you're talking about an organization, and in South America, to the side of Hezbollah. So you have an organization that is rapidly growing, that's operating, you know, on I think probably every continent, in a significant way, and it's operating half overtly because it's a Palestinian organization, and therefore it receives more support from the international left. So I think that that's important. Now, what were you asking?
Well, just from the standpoint of the of what we're seeing, the changes in Egypt as well, is that's helping with some of the activity taking place.
So look,
place
I mean,
Gaza.
We really. We dodged a very, very serious bullet with the Morsi regime of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. And I'm not sure if Americans are aware of just how dangerous the situation became after the Muslim Brotherhood took over in Egypt. You know, within months of Morsi's accession to power, you had, for the first time since 1979 Iranian Revolution, you had Iranian warships being permitted by the Egyptians to traverse the Suez Canal and sail to Syria through the Red Sea to the Mediterranean. And this was an extraordinarily dangerous situation. You had a rapprochement between Egypt and Iran, and if you remember, the Iranians played a role in the assassination of Anwar Sadat in 1981. They have a street in Tehran named after his assassin, so that they've had very bad relations. And with Morsi, you had the most powerful country in the Arab world with the most powerful military, completely American-made, in the Middle East, in the Arab world. That was moving very quickly towards developing an alliance with Iran. And the devastating implications of this were something that, for some bizarre reason, were lost on the Obama administration. So when Sisi and the Egyptian military overthrew the Morsi government with massive support of the public, that did not want, and the other thing, of course, internally inside of Egypt, they were transforming themselves very quickly into an Islamic state, a theocracy. So this was a bullet that we dodged. And so from my perspective, every step that we take away from that regime, it's not only a blessing, but it's something to really be grateful for. And every day that Sisi is president of Egypt, like, you should be saying a little bit of a thank you to God, because the cataclysmic implications of Egypt moving to the side of the jihadists are almost incalculable. So that was very important, and very important to recognize. And so Sisi, yes, I mean, he right now, you know, how long is he going to need Israel to survive? I don't know. But right now he does, and therefore we have the closest relations we've ever had with Syria, bar none. I mean, with Egypt, bar none. And it's, and again, I think it's very important to point out and to understand that Israel does is engaging very closely with the Sunni Arab states led by Sisi's Egypt and the Saudi regime. But these are not alliances like the U.S.-Israel alliance. These are not alliances of people. This is not something that you can look at and say that this is just always going to be, and right, that we're going to have these fantastic relations with our neighbors forever. We have no idea. I mean, look, Egypt had two regime changes after, you know, political stasis for half a century in a year and a half. So we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. We have to ride this wave for as long as we can and be prepared for the next day when it changes, so that we have to take maximum advantage of our working alliance of interests with these states, hope for the best, encourage them, of course, to liberalize, not democratize, but liberalize, because they're very illiberal, intolerant, anti-Semitic societies, but liberalize and ride this wave.
We had Avi Melamed on our program just this week. He was one of our speakers, and he talked about this axis of resistance going, you know, as Iran is trying to use Syria to connect over through Gaza. How can that axis be broken?
By the United States staying in eastern Syria and empowering the Kurds and acting in alliance with the Kurds in Syria, which are the only reliable ally that the United States and the West and just people who are, you know, of goodwill in general have in Syria. And unfortunately, the Trump administration does not seem to be acting in that manner. If the United States withdraws the 2,000 military forces that they have in eastern Syria today, and I understand that the president is interested in developing some sort of an Arab force that will take over the role that's now being played by U.S. military forces, you have to be very careful about who would be in that force. The United States has had bad experiences developing Arab fighting forces in the past. The Free Syria Army is just one example that the Obama administration subcontracted to Turkey, and in many ways those forces became sort of a seed that became ISIS. Whoops. So, you know, you have to just be careful, but you have to keep control of eastern Syria in the hands of good guys, and you have to empower the Kurds.
All right, Carolyn, we're up against another break. We're going to come back on the other side of the break, and I do want to get into the issue then of the two-state solution. Is that a solution? Every administration has talked about it. It has been embraced by many. Is it workable? Is it the solution? We're going to talk about that, Caroline Glick, my guest. Then we're going to be going to questions with our audience here. Don't go away. We're coming back with more Washington Watch after this.
Most people remember Frederick Douglass as a fiery speaker who denounced slavery and advocated for the civil rights of African Americans and women. What is less known is Douglass's commitment to faith and family. The month of February marked the bicentennial of Frederick Douglass's birth, so it is a fitting time to reflect on the legacy of this great author, scholar, humanitarian, and entrepreneur who served five United States presidents. In an exclusive Family Research Council speaker series event, Reverend Dean Nelson, chairman of the board for the Frederick Douglass Foundation, and Colin Hanna, president of Let Freedom Ring, explore the life of Douglass as a Christian minister, a husband, and a father, and examine how his legacy can be an example for Christian citizenship today. To view this important event, go to frc.org/Douglass. Again, that is frc.org/Douglass.
If you're like me, you care a lot about where our country is headed. With so much at stake in America, do our leaders have a way forward? To find out, mark your calendars for the Values Voters Summit on September 21st to 23rd in Washington, D.C., and join hundreds of Americans who, like you, want a culture in which human life is valued, families flourish, and religious liberty thrives. Past speakers at this conference include Donald Trump, Mike Pence, Mike Huckabee, Paul Ryan, Ben Carson, Steve Scalise, Kellyanne Conway, Kirk Cameron, Laura Ingraham, Dana Lash, Sean Hannity, and Mark Levine. On September 21st to 23rd, stand with Values Voters to restore our great nation. Registration is now open. Don't miss the special early bird price, but act fast. Visit valuesvotersummit.org for more information. That's valuesvotersummit.org.
This is Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins, broadcasting from Israel as we continue our tour through the Holy Land. So glad to have about 200 of our friends from across the United States joining us on this spectacular tour. Let me ask you, y'all having a good time? Are you learning more about what's actually happening here in the Middle East? Are we wearing you out? Are we feeding you well? All right. General, we are feeding you well, are we not? All right, I'm picking on my favorite general. That's right, our own general, General Jerry Boykin. All right, we're going to get back to our interview with Caroline and Ken Blackwell, poking him in the side laughing. My favorite mayor. All right, Caroline Glick, my guest. She is with the Jerusalem Post and Breitbart. Actually started writing with Breitbart in
a couple months ago.
All right, and also continuing to work with the Center for Security Policy. So pleased to have you with us. All right, we want to jump into this topic of the two-state solution. Is it a solution for what this conflict here in the Middle East?
Well, if you want to eliminate Israel, sure. but if that's not your goal, no, it's actually not a good idea. The two-state solution is predicated on a lot of bad ideas. Sitting in the hall with us today is former Congresswoman and my dear friend Michelle Bachmann, who was during her tenure
Absolutely.
In the House, during the tenure in the House. She started a caucus of members who to understand what alternatives to the establishment of a Palestinian state west of the Jordan River would be, and she was nice enough to have me be her inaugural speaker in the caucus. So I think she called it the Israeli Solution, which was my book, The Israeli Solution. But basically, the two-state solution is predicated on this idea.
And we'll put that at the bottom of the screen.
Yeah. That's okay. Israeli Solution, a one-state right. plan for peace in the Middle East by Carolyn B. Glick. Right. But the two-state solution is predicated on some basic foundational assumptions that are not only wrong, but insanely anti-Israel. Basically, it says that the reason that there's not peace between Israel and its neighbors is because there's no Palestinian state. And where is that state supposed to be located? It's supposed to be located on land that Israel controls and requires in order to survive. And so we learn from this two things. One is that the only side that is guilty for the absence of peace in the Middle East is Israel, because it's greedy. It takes all this land that's supposed to go to somebody else. Where have we heard Jews being called greedy before? Gee, I don't know. But so that's one thing, that it's inherently anti-Semitic. It's saying that Israel is guilty. Israel is to blame for the absence of peace because it controls land that somebody else should have in order to have a state. And if Israel just gives up all this land, then presto, you know, like you have fairy dust and Tinkerbell, everybody is going to suddenly change, and all of these countries and all of these societies that have been calling for death to the Jews for the past 100 bazillion years are going to change their mind, and they're all going to want to live at peace with Israel. So this is an incredible assumption. It places all of the onus, all of the responsibility for the absence of peace on one state that has been constantly and chronically victimized and rejected by all of the nations in the region. And the wonderful thing about it is that if you can blame Israel for the absence of peace, and you don't have to actually pay attention to anything going on and in the other countries, you can just put the squeeze on Israel, demand that it cough up more concessions, give away more land, give more concrete to Hamas to build tunnels to attack Israel, et cetera, et cetera. You give them more money to the PLO that they can use to indoctrinate their children to become suicide bombers. You do all of this, and you don't care what's happening in their areas, because, again, the only side that's responsible for the absence of peace is Israel. So that's why you have had for generations American policy makers flying blind with everything related to the Arab world. So, for instance, in my book, I write about the fact that in 1982, when the U.S. forces came into Beirut, the Marines, they thought that Israel was a problem, right? Because we were occupying somebody else's land. And so when the progenitor of Hezbollah blew up the Marine barracks in Beirut in October of 1982, the Americans didn't know what hit them, because they thought that the Lebanese would support them because they were pushing the Israeli forces out of Beirut. They thought that the problem was Israel, and if they could get the Israeli forces out of Beirut, nobody would bother them. So, too, I was an embedded journalist with the 3rd Infantry Division in the invasion of Iraq in 2003. There's no society in the Arab world, well, Syria, but Iraq is very similar to Lebanon from a demographic perspective, from a political perspective. When you look at all of the warring factions inside of Iran and what the nature of Saddam's regime was and his sort of interaction with the other factions in Iraqi society. So the best case study for Americans to have studied before the invasion of Iraq was Israel's experience of 18 years of war in Lebanon. But again, the Americans learned nothing from Israel's experience in Lebanon, because they thought that Israel was a problem in Lebanon. And so all of the things we did, they experienced in Iraq, and they were flying blind in there.
There's that music again. Yeah. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back with questions from our audience here of Caroline Glick. So don't go away. You're listening to Washington Watch, and we're coming right back after this.
There, let's play a word association game. Are you ready? When I say Washington, D.C., what's the first thing you think of? If you're like many Americans, a word like corruption might top the list, but Christian might be the last thing you'd associate with Washington, D.C. Well, the truth is that Christians have voice in our nation's capital. For over 35 years, Family Research Council has been working daily to advance faith, family, and freedom in public policy and culture from a Christian worldview. When the Christian worldview is being pushed out of the public, FRC is there to stand firm on a biblical vision for America. Will you stand with us? To learn more about Family Research Council and to find out how you can stand with us in defense of faith, family, and freedom, please visit frc.org and follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest news and ways you can take action. Again, that's frc.org.
Hey, I'm back. I brought food. What's the score?
98%.
What?
My congressman got a 98% on the Family Research Council Action scorecard.
You are such a nerd.
Family Research Council Action created a new scorecard to help others understand how well their member of Congress is doing on the things that are important to you. Like how your representatives voted on taxpayer funding for abortion, repealing and replacing Obamacare, the confirmation of Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court, and other important legislation relating to faith, family, and freedom.
Really? I barely know my congressman. Let me look this up. How do I get the info on this?
Go to frcaction.org/scorecard. Once you find out how your representative voted on these issues, you should let them know your thoughts and keep them accountable. Whoa, you're typing it all wrong. It's frcaction.org/scorecard.
Okay, I got it now. I'll keep an eye for my representatives for any foul balls.
Hello, this is Tony Perkins from Washington Watch. You know, in all my years here at the Family Research Council, one of the things that encourages me the most about you, our listeners, is your willingness to help advance the things that matter most, faith, family, and freedom. Your support is enabling FRC to play a major role in the current administration's actions to protect religious freedom, as well as rolling back threats to pastors' free speech rights, just to name a few. But your help is needed for the work ahead as we seek to protect religious freedom in the military and finally defund Planned Parenthood. Please stand with FRC right at this moment. You can make your gift by going to TonyPerkins.com or make a gift by calling 1-800-225-4008. Again, our number 800-225-4008 or go to TonyPerkins.com. God bless you and may God bless the United States of America.
You are listening to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. So glad that you are with us here in Israel. Caroline Glick, my guest, she is with the Jerusalem Post, writes for them, as well as Breitbart, and also still working with the Center for Security Policy, and actually has a couple of books that she's written. One State, The Israel Solution, A One State Plan for Peace in the Middle East. Shackled Warrior, Israel in the Global Jihad. Caroline, before we go to our first question, I think we have a question, and we have an incoming question here from General Boykin. We're going to let him ask a question. And I know everybody's kin clapping for you. We were talking about the two-state solution, and that's actually been put on the table. Israel has under, I think, pressure from the United States and the international community said, okay, we'll work, we'll do our part. But is it not true that the reason that's never been tried is because they refuse, the Palestinians refuse to recognize Israel's right to exist?
Yes. I mean, Israel has made repeated offers to the Palestinians that involved giving them essentially everything that they demand. So, okay, take it. Take Jerusalem. We offered them Jerusalem twice in 2000 and 2008, and they never even responded with a counteroffer. They never even responded at all. And so everything that they wanted, Israel has offered them repeatedly in great detail, and they don't want it because they don't want to do the one thing that Israel requests in response to this extraordinary largesse. And that is for them to recognize Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state. They won't do it because that is the root of the problem. That is the reason. It's not because Israel's too big. It's because they don't care how big Israel is. They don't want us here. They're serious when they say they want to throw us all into the sea.
And I think that's an extremely important fact to be known. All right, we're going to go to questions now. And our first question is going to come from General Jerry Boykin.
Thanks for being here, Caroline. And
thank
you can
you.
See that I get picked on a lot here in this this organization. But look, you're a heroine. If Donald Trump asked you to sit down with him right now and advise him on what to do about the Iran deal, what would you tell him?
You walk away. Just walk away. Just walk away. You can't turn those lemons into lemonade. There's not enough sugar in all the world to turn those lemons into lemonade. It's a corrupt deal. It's a terrible deal. It's a deal that already massively empowered the Iranian regime, gave it an extension of its lifespan. It was already falling apart economically. Now we see, again, the Iranian currency is in the toilet. You're having mass demonstrations all over the country every single day of the week. Nobody's covering it because, whatever, we know what the media is about. But they're falling apart. I mean, and I'll just give you one other example, which is that last night, I think it was, that I saw on the news that I don't know if you guys have been following the demonstrations on Twitter or wherever, but there was there's this Wednesday, the No Hijab Wednesdays. So these incredibly brave Iranian women are getting up in public and waving their hijabs, walking down the streets. And, you know, you have Linda Sarsour, who's supposed to be a feminist in the United States. Well, I won't go there. But, here you have these women in Iran who are risking their lives and their families in order to say, leave me alone and stop telling me I have to be covered up. I don't want to do this anymore. So in one of these videos, you saw a woman who was a young student in Tehran, and the morality police, yes, they actually exist, and they're very powerful in Iran, these female goons came up to her and started beating the, whatever out of her, beating the stuffing out of her, brutally, because she wasn't wearing a hijab. She was wearing a hijab, but it wasn't tight enough around her neck, you see. So she deserved to just be bludgeoned by these females. And so it went viral in Iran, this video, and because it went outside of Iran and it went back into Iran. And the regime got very scared because people got very, very angry because people hate the regime in Iran. And so suddenly you see Rouhani, the president, supposedly moderate, saying, well, that was probably a mistake, and, you have to... You attract more flies with honey than with you know what, and so you just they're very contrite. And the head of the morality police, I think, was saying it was a mistake. So the point is, they're very stressed. This is not how a regime responds if they are not concerned about being overthrown. And if the Americans leave the Iran deal, then that is going to block them from the international banking system essentially permanently. That's the cause of the mass inflation that they're having now and the devaluation of their currency. That's going to put an enormous amount of stress on the Germans in particular to reduce their trade with Iran. And, what you say, at least what I always say, is if you don't want your enemy messing with you, then mess with him. If he's busy at home, he's going to have a lot less time to focus on being busy outside of his home. And the interesting thing about the Iranian people is that they're not interested in spending billions of dollars a year on the war in Syria and the war and the support for Hezbollah and Hamas. They don't approve of this. So that it's not that Iran can do like a Soviet two-step or whatever and blame the Americans or blame the Israelis, because the regime itself is so hated that they don't have an option to go outside of Iran in an aggressive way to try to shore up their legitimacy at home. So the walking away from the Iran deal will be a massive blow to the regime, will destabilize it, and only good things can happen as a consequence.
This is Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. Caroline Glick, my guest, as we continue our tour throughout Israel. And our next question comes from...
Bob from Rapid City, South Dakota. Many of us in America are very, very thankful for Benjamin Netanyahu. And during the time when we had Barack Obama, we thought he was really the leader of the free world. Can he survive what he's going through here in the investigations?
So the police are investigating Netanyahu in three, I think, different criminal probes. And so far, they all seem to be kind of nothing. And the interesting thing here is that, we have a situation not unlike the situation that you have in the United States, where our mass media organizations are overwhelmingly and sort of unbelievably hateful towards Netanyahu and towards the Israeli right. They're very, very dominated by the left. And so they have been pushing the police to aggressively pursue these investigations and so on and so forth. And when the headlines were going every single day, Netanyahu is going to get indicted and he's going to get indicted and blah, 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 his approval ratings kept going up and up and up, so that they were really surprised on the television and the radio and everything like that, because they would have these round-the-clock saturation coverage of the criminal probes against Netanyahu. They even had like special graphics that they had made just for the occasion of, you know, getting everybody angry with him on the various news programs. And yet the Likud was polling, say, 26 seats in the Knesset when this started, and now it's up to, you know, 30 seats, and the right-wing bloc in the Knesset keeps growing. So, you know, as far as the public is concerned, he's going to be reelected, and the public doesn't want him to leave. And the angrier the police become at Netanyahu, the less the public trusts the police. I know that this might sound unbelievable to you. You've never heard anything like this of any, you know, any kind going on in the United States. But it's interesting the similarities that we're seeing between the elites in the United States and in Israel and the voters.
It is very interesting. There is a strong parallel, because what we see in the United States, despite the repeated attacks and the failure to actually report the good things that are being done by the Trump administration, his support among the core base of evangelicals in particular has not moved going into his second year. Let me ask you this. With the move of the embassy to Jerusalem, does that actually help Prime Minister Netanyahu? From a public perspective, that he was had the relationship with Donald Trump.
Yes. First, the short answer is yes, absolutely. It doesn't only help Netanyahu. I mean, it helps Israel, and I think that more important than helping Netanyahu is that, you know, I mean, think about it. We just celebrated our 70th anniversary of our independence. 70 years. And for 70 years, the United States has refused to have its embassy in our capital city. That's an amazing thing, and it sends a signal to the entire world that there's something contingent about Israel's existence, right? I mean, if you don't recognize a country's capital city, right, what are you saying? What is the message that you're communicating? You're communicating the message that the legitimacy of the existence of this state is contingent, which is horrible. It's horrible. Contingent on making peace with terrorists, contingent on I don't know what, contingent on the Messiah coming. Who knows? It's contingent. We don't have a right to exist like everybody else. We have to do something to prove that we have a right to exist. And until we prove it, whatever it is, and it keeps changing, you know, from decade to decade, you're going to not recognize our capital. So aside from everything else, this is an extraordinary affront to a country that is the only stable U.S. ally in the Middle East, bar none. You know, we were talking before about the instability in the Sunni Arab world. We know what a mess Lebanon is and what Iran and blah, blah, blah. The only country in the Middle East that the United States can take to the bank is Israel. It's not nothing that, you know, American leaders have said that Israel is the most powerful aircraft carrier in the U.S. arsenal. You can plop down anything here and know that it's secure, anything at all. And yet this country, this extraordinary diamond in the U.S. arsenal, has been treated like garbage for 70 years. So if nothing else, you know, by recognizing Israel's right to exist, aside from, you know, ending this affront, the Americans suddenly, after 70 years, are saying something else. They're saying, we're back in business, all right? We're credible. We're going to do the right thing. And the most beautiful thing about it, which is why I think it was so attractive to President Trump, is it doesn't cost you a dime, right? Nothing, nothing. You change the sign on the consulate, you build a wall, which Israel's probably paying for anyway. Talk about Mexico, right? You build a blast wall. We're paying for, I think. And And voila, you have just sent the most powerful message to the nations of the Middle East and to the nations of the world, that the United States stands with its allies and opposes its enemies that anybody could imagine. So the implications here for America are extraordinary, and obviously for Israel.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins, Caroline Glick, my guest, and our next question is from...
John from Michigan. You dropped the name of a country at the very beginning that I've not heard much about, and that's Turkey. What's happening in Turkey? Obviously, their leader there is getting more anti-Israel, more pro-Muslim. He's rabble-rousing his population with 2 to 3 major speeches every week from what I'm hearing. What's happening in Turkey?
So Turkey is a really bad news story. You know, if Israel is the good news story of the year, of the decade, of the century, whatever, Turkey is a bad news story because, you know, in 2002, the end of 2002, the Islamist party, the AKP party, Justice and Peace Party in Turkey, won the parliamentary elections. And in the intervening 16 years, this Islamist party has taken Turkey from a secular Western power that was a very strong member of NATO, the second most powerful military in NATO after the U.S., and transformed itself into an Islamic theocracy, a dictatorship that is run by one man, Recep Erdogan, who envisions himself as the new Ottoman emperor and envisions the reconstitution of the Ottoman empire in the Middle East under his leadership. He wants to rebuild the caliphate under his leadership as it was under the sultanate of the Ottoman Empire. It's becoming a massively anti-American country. If you look at the news, if you look at the entertainment, the best-selling books, they're viciously, murderously anti-American. People are being indoctrinated to hate the United States. Children are increasingly being taught not in secular education, but in madrasas. And so this is a mess, and there's no easy way to deal with it, because if the United States drops Turkey, then Turkey becomes a Russian ally. If the United States keep Turkey, then it comes at the expense of the Kurds, which are the only stable ally the United States has in a lot of these countries. So it's really a very difficult situation and a bad one.
Well, Caroline, that's going to have to be our last question. We're up against the final break of the program. How can folks find out more about the work that you do?
Well, they can come to my website, carolineglick.com, which I try to update. I'm not always great at it, but it has all my articles backlogged till 2002. And you can read my book, The Israeli Solution, a one-state plan for peace in the Middle East, and tune into my Facebook page and Twitter feed.
All right. Thanks so much for being with us. And, folks, thank you for joining us as well. And, folks, thank you for being a part of Washington Watch. I encourage you to check out the website, TonyPerkins.com, links to all types of resources and information. And until next time, I leave you with the encouraging words of the Apostle Paul found in Ephesians 6, where he says, when you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, when you've prepared, and when you have taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.